Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Ben.
And I'm Freddie.
And on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, we pick apart the local election results, we talk about what happened at Stormont, and you ask us about the Beergate scandal. So after a weekend of election results, we have a clearer picture than last time we recorded of what the lay of the land is. Ben Walker, our polling expert, is back to join us. And Freddie Haywood, our political reporter, is also here to discuss the fallout. And then we'll be talking separately about the Stormont results after this. So we're just sticking to England, Scotland and Wales for this part of the podcast. The Conservatives were punished in their southern heartlands and some totemic seats in London. And Labour seemed to return to or just slightly fall back on its position in traditional sort of Labour voting, so-called red wall areas in the North and Midlands that it held in 2018. And actually, you know, 2018 is quite significant because let's not forget the red wall hadn't crumbled by then. And the Lib Dems appear to have turned a corner. They've made some significant gains. They seem quite confident. And the Greens continued their sort of impressive stretch of local election advances, taking seats off the Tories and the Labour Party. So Ben, first of all, let's go to you. Who, according to your analysis, was it a good and bad night for?
Thank you for having me. It's not clear cut. It's just too nuanced. It's really annoying because I've been watching, covering, staying up all night for local elections since 2013, 2014. And this is the local elections where every local authority is sort of swinging in a different way as each other. So you have Colchester and you have the Lib Dems and Greens gaining, and then you have Stevenage and you have Labour gaining, and then you have Swindon, you have Labour gaining, and then you have Nuneaton and Amber Valley and you have the Tories gaining. It's not uniform and it's quite annoying. If you're looking at who's going to be the largest party at the next election, Labour's fulfilled that. Labour's going to be the largest party at the next election based on the results we've had here. But I feel like the narrative sometimes doesn't line up with that, because what are we comparing against 2018? 2018 was a time when Labour was winning, albeit barely, as you say, just the so-called red wall. And it was also at a time when Labour was polling 40% in the polls and the Tories were polling 40% in the polls. Now Labour's polling 40% and the Tories are polling, what, 36, 35, 34% sometimes, right? So Tories have fallen since then. And I just want to sort of look at both the marginals, the red wall, and indeed the traditional ones. So perfect example of what's happened. Take, for example, Hartlepool. In 2018, the Tories led the vote over Labour there by 12 points. In 2021, they also led by 12 points. This year, Labour had a lead in Hartlepool of 9 percentage points. That's a big swing. That's a significant shift in support. Take Wakefield as well. Last year, across the borough, not just the parliamentary seat, Labour had a lead in the popular vote of 7 points. Now they have a lead of 24 points. That's big. That is a significant shift. Take Walsall in the Black Country, in the West Midlands. Last year, Tories led it by 15 points. In 2018, Tories led it by 5 points. Again, this was a time when Labour was winning the so-called red wall. This year, just a few short days ago, Labour and the Tories were neck and neck. They tied in terms of the popular vote. So in these so-called red wall boroughs, you see a big recovery for Labour. If you want to talk who won the red wall, in terms of overall numbers, Labour did. But it's not uniform. It's not the same. Whilst Labour advanced in Dudley, they still were losing seats in Wolverhampton, Bushbury North, that you visited, Anoush. The Tories gained that ward off Labour at the same time as losing neighbouring wards to Labour. It's a bit mixed. But if you even to look at the traditional targets, the old marginals, the ones that were fought over in 2010, 2015, like Swindon, Southampton, Plymouth, Milton Keynes. Last year in Milton Keynes, the Tories had a 10-point lead in terms of the overall vote. This year, Labour had a 2-point lead. Swindon, last year, the Tories had a 25-point lead. This year, Labour had a 3-point lead. And Derby, which hasn't seen a lead for Labour in quite some time, in 2018, it was Con plus 9, 2019, Con plus 1, 2021, Con plus 4. This year, Lab plus 4. We are seeing some pretty significant shifts, not just in the so-called red wall, but in the older traditional marginals that often now get mixed because all of our politics is really sort of shaped around the red wall, isn't it?
Yes. And actually, what's interesting is because there's this obsession with the red wall, which I know all of us, you know, slightly cringe at as a metaphor, that means that any symbolic wins in those kind of places for Labour or symbolic holds are particularly important in terms of the narrative and also in terms of the morale within the party. So that majority in Cumberland is really important because, you know, one of the three constituencies that that council covers is Workington, which was the hometown of Workington Man, which was this 2019 kind of caricature of the new working class Tory voter. And then also you had Labour holding Sunderland as well. Sunderland has become this sort of Brexit ground zero, hasn't it, in terms of our political discourse. And so, you know, those two things will be important for the party when it is trying to counter the narrative that it is falling back in the red wall, or at least not making gains or, you know, making the inroads or advances that it's supposed to if it's supposed to be winning those places back in a general.
If you want to go overall net terms in the Labour vote, in Labour seats, they're standing still, okay? Mm. That doesn't sound as interesting or as exciting as, say, advancing big time like the Greens or the Lib Dems, but the Lib Dems are coming from a lower base. The Greens are definitely coming from a lower base. What is happening that's seeing such significant swings in both the so-called red wall and indeed in the traditional marginals is the Tory vote just collapsing. And that reflects the polls. The narrative may be different, but what happened on Thursday is a reflection of the national opinion polls that you are seeing. Labour is doing the bare minimum to be the largest party in Parliament. A chance for majority? Not really. Nah, no chance, to be honest with you, at the moment. They need to do so much more. They still have a brand issue. You know, for all that Starmer leads Johnson on, you know, likability, it's just because he's been standing still. Whereas Johnson and Tories have been falling back. And that's been reflected in the council seat wins. You know, it's all Tory fall as opposed to Labour rise. And I think every time I come on this podcast, I say that, don't I?
Yeah. And Freddie, I mean, Labour can take some confidence from its results in Wales and Scotland as well. It moved back to being the second party after the SNP in Scottish councils. And I think the Conservatives now have no councils in Wales.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. When you actually look at the breakdown of what or where Labour won their seats, Wales was a massive part of that. Them coming second in Scotland was also huge, mostly because of their huge collapse in 2015. So them making inroads in Wales and in Scotland is also vital for their performance at the next general election. I mean, one of the problems that they've had in previous general elections is that they don't have a big bank of seats to sort of draw on in Scotland and in Wales. So them or their recovering in Scotland and Wales in these local elections, in some parts anyway, is cause for hope, perhaps, for the next general election.
And we're coming on to Beergate in You Ask Us, but I mean, is there any feeling of elation within the Labour Party or enthusiasm over these results, or have they been overshadowed by political events?
Well, that's definitely how they want it to come across. They want to portray it as a huge victory, a turning point, as they always talk about. But I don't think that's what we've definitely seen, and that's not the feeling widespread around Westminster at all, really. What you've had is, as always happens with elections, the narrative is set earlier in the day, and then people already make up their minds before the full results are in. So as Ben was pointing out, over the weekend, as the full results emerge, you actually saw Tory losses speed up, and they got to the far end of what would be deemed as disastrous. So I think the narrative was set in slightly favourable terms for the Tories, and you didn't see the same positivity you might have seen if Labour's results came out a bit earlier, or their good results came out a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I think the Conservatives were sort of winning the spin game, weren't they, particularly in the morning after election night. But as the results came sort of flooding out, you had more and more voices within the Conservative Party, particularly in southern seats, expressing concern. Do you think that's going to be the area of contention for the Conservative Party going forward? Are they going to have to placate their backbenchers in the south?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you don't ever want to read too much into off-the-record comments from Tory MPs saying they're disgruntled with the leadership, because we've been having that for months now, and we've not really seen a concerted effort to bring down Boris Johnson. So, but with that said, it's not all just about a leadership change. There's also the policy question as well, and what, for instance, you know, we've got the Queen's speech tomorrow. What are the government going to announce to, in as you say, placate their backbench MPs from the south, but also to try and win back some of that traditional Tory vote that they may have lost on Thursday?
It's interesting because they have already sort of been trying to placate them, haven't they, in terms of those planning changes that Robert Jenrick, the former housing secretary, wanted to bring in. They've completely changed that formula so that house building won't be happening as heavily in those home counties, shire kind of areas. But that doesn't seem to have stopped this drop off in support in those seats that kind of the flood began in the Chesham and Amersham by-election. Ben, do you think the blue wall and the blue wall crumble is a real thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And a blue wall crumble. Gosh, we need to make a dessert for that at the New Statesman, don't we? But
Eaton mess.
Oh, yes, absolutely. blue wall. It depends what you call the blue wall. If you think blue wall is Remain voting graduates, forget it. Stick to just traditionally Tory seats. Seats that have voted Tory in the past, because one perfect example is in the north, the spa town of Harrogate and Knaresborough, where I'm from, that has in local elections never voted anything other than Conservative since 2011, since the arrival of the coalition. And this year that changed. For the first time in 10, 12, 13 years, Harrogate and Knaresborough voted, if you tot up the results, for the Liberal Democrats, and a 1,000 vote majority. That's pretty significant. That's a sign of the trends to come, perhaps in the future, and indeed down south. Now down south, what we're seeing is commuter belt towns, these types of places that, you know, that's an hour commute from London, an hour commute from basically your workplace, that I think do show a risk of becoming a little bit more competitive, partly because demographics, you know, if you make a bit of money in London, you're more likely to live further afield. Also, house prices have pushed you out of London. They've also pushed you out of Brighton. And that's why we saw significant Labour gains on the Sussex coast in a borough called Worthing and Ada. 2017, Labour had no councillors here, and now they have majority control of the council. That's Tim Lawton's seat and Sir Peter Bottomley's. Keep an eye on those. But it's not just Labour, Lib Dems as well in St Albans, across bits of Hertfordshire. You have also West Oxfordshire, basically David Cameron's former constituency, where you saw some pretty surprising big Lib Dem gains, and South Cambridgeshire. You know, you live in Cambridge, you move further afield, you decide to live in more like South Cambridgeshire, maybe Huntingdonshire. It's partly people moving, and it's also partly of a change in what actually matters to people locally. Housing. Housing's now playing a bigger part. People now care about this. So half the people want new houses, the other half don't. And so the Conservatives think, let's make it a wedge issue. Let's stand for only one side. And that they are suffering as a consequence. If you look at a map of the East Coast main line and you go all the way up to Peterborough, a lot of the seats up for grabs were very blue. Now, a lot of them are very yellow, and a fair chunk of them are very red as well. It is Commuterville that is seeing a bit of a swing against the Tories here. Milton Keynes, perfect example. These, in 2019, very safe seats. Now, if I mentioned correctly earlier, Labour have a popular vote lead across the borough of 2 percentage points. Blue wall, traditional marginals, these are seeing similar issues, and they are swinging as a consequence. They're going to be very interesting in the next few years.
It's so interesting because it's sort of an oxymoronic support for the Lib Dems, isn't it? Kind of, we don't want house building here, but also our children can't buy houses anymore. I think those two are definitely sort of driving that turn away from the Tories in some Absolutely. Of those seats that you mentioned. Not sure that those people are going to get what they want, but anyway. The most significant election result was, of course, away from Great Britain. It was that of the Stormont Assembly, where there was a historic victory for Sinn Féin, the first time a Nationalist Party has won the most seats and therefore has won the right to nominate the First Minister. Ben, I know your epic map is only for Britain, but you must have been following those results in Northern Ireland as well. And really what happened was there was a split in support for unionist parties, which meant that Sinn Féin came first. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. If you were to summarise the local election results in England, Labour stood still and the Tories collapsed. In Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin stood still, or, you know, upped their vote share by one percentage point, and the DUP collapsed. They fell by 7 percentage points. Actually, that's actually quite the same, really, with England. Yeah. What you had is unionism, unionist parties. They really have... How about this? I want you to sort of imagine the Tory party under, say Michael Howard or Ian Duncan Smith being the same Tory party as now. It doesn't change. It has done nothing. It's not shifted with the times. Its social attitudes have not changed. That's what the DUP has sort of done, and they've suffered as a consequence. Unionist voters today are not the unionist voters of the 1990s or the early 2000s. They've evolved. They've become a little bit more progressive, and there's less of them because you have that third share of the pie in Northern Ireland. Now, that's not necessarily nationalist or not necessarily unionist, and unionist parties are doing very little to appeal to them. But the nationalist parties aren't doing too bad, actually. Sinn Féin, they have been picking up a little bit of support amongst younger people, amongst less nationalist people, people less focused with questions of a border poll or anything that really, you know, Westminster obsesses about. They're more concerned with the cost of living, health. The protocol does appear in those polls there. But really, yeah, Sinn Féin stood still and benefited as a consequence. They are the largest party in the Northern Irish Assembly. The Alliance Party, this is the party most popular amongst the young, most popular amongst that third slice of the pie. They saw a 5-point increase in their share of the vote. Not as much as the polls expected, but it is a historic result because, again, you have a nationalist party in first place and you have a non-aligned party in third. It is exciting, and who knows what the future holds for Northern Ireland.
Well, there's a really interesting piece on the New Statesman website at the moment by Jonathan Powell, who was the chief government negotiator in the Good Friday Agreement, who says that actually that alliance vote is probably the most crucial outcome of this election in the long term. And he makes a really interesting point, suggesting this election outcome might be the beginning of Northern Ireland going down the route of sort of traditional left and right parties rather than the old green and orange rivalries, which is quite an interesting analysis of the results. You know, I do encourage our listeners to go and read what he's written. But, you know, although this is being written up as this seismic result, really the outcome, at least in the short term, is going to be stasis, isn't it? The executive had already collapsed back in February. The DUP are being very hardline now about refusing to enter into another power sharing coalition until that Northern Ireland protocol is, well, significantly reformed, or, you know, probably from their perspective, scrapped. They call it an existential threat to Northern Ireland's place within the union. So really, are we just looking at nothing happening now, Freddie? I mean, the Northern Ireland Secretary, Brandon Lewis, is meeting the leaders of the main parties to try and get them to form a new executive. But that seems pretty unlikely, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I think you are right. And not much has changed. I mean, I think from the perspective of Britain, people often see these elections in Northern Ireland from a completely constitutional perspective. But as Ben was talking about, lots of issues came up as well during the election that weren't to do with the constitution. And that's demonstrated in the surge in the Alliance Party. I mean, Sinn Féin also talking about the economy, the cost of living. And then it actually on that constitutional issue itself, I mean, Brandon Lewis, the Northern Ireland Secretary, has pointed out that unionists still hold more seats than the nationalists in the Assembly. And why is that important? Well, because, I mean, according to the Good Friday Agreement, it's up to the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland to decide whether there is a reunification referendum. So it matters what he thinks. And in no sense is that going to happen anytime soon. So as you say, that debate hasn't gone forward too much, even if we've got this historic victory for Sinn Féin.
And so does it make it more likely that the UK government is going to make good on its, you know, it's always briefing the whole time that the next day it's going to unilaterally rip up the protocol? You know, there's constant threats to do that. It hasn't quite come through on those threats. But do you think this makes that more likely to happen? I mean, surely the political context in terms of Europe makes that, you know, far less appetizing for UK ministers picking that fight with the EU during a cost of living crisis when there's also an actual war going on NATO's doorstep.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't think you're going to see much change there either. I mean, you may get, as you're seeing with Brandon Lewis this week, an increased engagement with Northern Ireland, particularly as the effects of not having a government in Northern Ireland really come to bear. I mean, you've got to remember, when there is no executive, which has not been there since February, as you say, when the DUP left the executive, you do lose the capacity to make executive decisions. not in full, but a significant part of the Northern Irish government just stops working. So it stasis both in terms of the politics, but also in terms of the government as well. And I think that is going to eventually come to bear, and the UK government have to try even harder to resolve that. And as you say, will they want to pick a fight with the EU within this broader political context? I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think there will be a big announcement in the Queen's speech tomorrow. There might be a little bit on the Northern Ireland Protocol, but we're not going to see that immediately come to the fore. So as you said, I don't think massive amounts have changed, or if things are going to change, it's going to take a few months for that to come about.
Yeah. And of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling thing, doesn't it, when they don't have an operating executive sort of limping on with this caretaker government. It means that life only gets more frustrating for Northern Irish people. You know, they're subject to big societal problems at the moment, the most extreme being NHS waiting times. And Ben, we saw in the Irish general election, Sinn Féin kind of campaigning on those bread and butter issues and doing well from it. I think they got the most first preference votes in that election. So, you know, it gives that party a more and more opportunity to campaign on these kind of social affairs issues that are so affecting people's day-to-day lives.
In the run-up to the election, the polling out there is actually quite similar to how Brits across Great Britain feel about its cost of living, its rebuilding. There's a perception amongst the Northern Irish that they really have suffered as a consequence of COVID. And you know, if you rank the top three issues facing Northern Irish residents, rebuilding your country comes, I think, third or second. Northern Irish residents were not concerned with the constitution or borders or anything like that. Well, to 1% of voters, it did actually appear as an option, the constitution, and it was of great import to 1% of nationalists and 1.4% of unionists. It really is the cost of living. It's the rebuilding. It's recovery from COVID. It is a bit protocol, but yeah, it's similar to the rest of the country. It's what's going on in your pocket that matters to Northern Irish residents.
Hi, it's Anoush here. This is just a reminder that as a podcast listener, you have the option of subscribing to The New Statesman with a very special offer. You can subscribe for just £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for £12 if you go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. We'll be right back.
From The New Statesman comes a new podcast, Audio Long Reads. The best of our reported features and essays read aloud.
Songs are like tattoos, Mitchell said on Blue. Having one written about you is immortality and fiction rolled into one.
Featuring writing from our authors, including Kate Mossman on Joni Mitchell's former muse and lover, Jeremy Cliff on his journey through France before this year's presidential election, and Sophie McBain on the refugee crisis.
Don't die, he kept shouting. He didn't answer when Mardworth screamed back, "Who is dying?"
Ease into the weekend with our audio long reads, published every Saturday morning. Just search Audio Long Reads wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
All right. This is a question from Tom. Thanks for submitting a question. Is there an upside to Beergate for Keir Starmer? Not only is he getting practice of being asked questions he doesn't want to answer during an election about something no one genuinely cares about, but also his image of being posh and from Islington starts to degrade due to its continual proximity to the words beer and curry. Now, I get the impression that Tom had his tongue firmly in his cheek when he wrote this question in, because, I mean, if you guys don't mind, I might just take the first stab at it, because I think that this suggestion that no one genuinely cares about it is very much an assumption. When I was out reporting, obviously it was before the Durham police had confirmed that they would be reinvestigating this beer and curry night that Keir Starmer and some Labour advisers had while they were working in Durham. I was out reporting, and people did mention Partygate a lot, but what they often said, and I think I've bored you with this observation on the podcast before, but what they often said was they're all as bad as each other. You know, people would explicitly say, oh, well, Labour would have done the same thing if they were in. So Partygate has had this impact, not only of dragging down the Tories' reputation, but dragging down in some areas of the country the reputation of politicians in general, which was already pretty rock bottom. So I think a story like this is only going to feed that kind of sentiment. And it may even give people an excuse to carry on supporting the Conservatives, who they've nevertheless feel betrayed by or disappointed in, because they can tell themselves, oh, well, Labour would have done the same, or Labour's exactly the same. So I don't think this is something that no one genuinely cares about. And then the second part of the question about the proximity to the words beer and curry, you know, it is ironic, isn't it, that in our very, very basic reading of politics, it used to be a good thing for a politician to seem like someone you'd go and have a beer with. And now it's a bad thing for a politician to seem like someone you'd go and have a beer with. But that's how politics works. And it has worked to the disadvantage of Keir Starmer both times, I think. So I don't think there's an upside at all, not least because the Labour Party has worked very hard to build this reputation of him as this forensic, sensible, safe pair of hands. Lisa Nandy was out on the media round calling him Mr. Rules. If you build your leader's reputation on being meticulous about following the rules and forensic about picking apart the Prime Minister's rule breaking, then you really do open yourself up to accusations of hypocrisy if you do anything that could possibly be interpreted as rule breaking. So I would say that it doesn't help Keir Starmer at all, but I do appreciate that Tom is probably being slightly ironic in his question. What do you guys think?
Yes, I'm struggling to find an upside as well. I did allude to something in Morning Call this morning, because I do think, well, on the bad side, it means that Labour's attack line on Partygate is completely undermined, because the Tories can just scream hypocrite as soon as it occurs. And whether that's true or not, the different Partygate versus Beergate, they're very different things and in very different circumstances. But nonetheless, it completely undermines their attack line on Partygate. But if that means that, as Jacob Rees-Mogg intimated last night, that the focus shifts to the cost of living, I think Labour have an opportunity there to really drill down on that and to try and hit the Tories on that issue. And I think one of the criticisms of Keir Starmer at recent PMQs before the prorogation was that he didn't focus on the cost of living over Partygate. And as we know, I think, Ben, you did a chart for us last week showing that one of the main, or if not the main reason that 2019 Tory voters moved away from the Tories on Thursday was the cost of living. So yes, I don't think there is an upside, because it was helpful to contrast Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson on that point. But it doesn't mean it's completely bad, because the other political issues in the narrative at the moment could actually suit Labour's priorities.
Yeah, I don't think there's any upside to Keir Starmer, but if you want to be a cynic, there could be an upside to the Labour Party, which is that Keir Starmer demonstrates his principles by resigning, if fined. And to be honest with you, we just had some polling this morning, right? And from YouGov, great pollsters, very off the gun there. If Keir Starmer is fined by police for Beergate, he should resign or remain in his role. 46% say resign, 32% say remain in his role. And interestingly enough, 54% of all voters, not just those who've paid attention to the news, 54% of all voters say he probably or definitely did break the rules. Just 21% think he didn't. And Labour voters split 33% he did, 42% he didn't. Interestingly enough as well, those who voted Labour in 2019 say if Keir Starmer is fined for the alleged breaking of lockdown rules, 48% of Labour voters say he should resign, 32% say he should remain in his role. I think the opportunity here for Keir Starmer to demonstrate his principles that he'd like to talk about are absolutely there, but that does require him to resign and fall on his own sword. Whether he does that, who knows? But voters are definitely paying attention. They've noticed this. And as Anoush said earlier, yes, voters now associate Partygate, the levels of perceived corruption during the coronavirus crisis, they all associate as like, it's all you politicians. It's not the Tory politicians, it's all of you. And Labour could have definitely benefited from this, but they didn't. And to be honest with you, Actually, I say they could have benefited. I wondered if they can. I'm not entirely sure now, really. It feels like the expenses scandal all over again. You're all as bad as each other, pigs in the trough. You've all done bad. I'm going to vote for different parties. But when that feeling was prevalent in 2009, it was the BNP and UKIP that saw big gains in the then Euro elections. This time around, we saw big gains for the Greens and Lib Dems. It might be worth looking at the local election results with that lens, maybe. A plague on both your houses by voters.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Ben Walker and Freddie Haywood. We're produced by May Robson, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a nice review.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.